To read a book by Mary Gaitskill is to slip into the shadows, to explore worlds that aren't easy to live in and I don't think are easy to move out of. Bad Behavior, and that's a book of short stories, and Two Girls, Fat and Thin, Mary Gaitskill's first novel, take a look at worlds we don't frequently acknowledge, but at least for some, move under the surface of polite conversation. This is Conversations, and on this edition, we'll talk with fiction writer and essayist, Mary Gaitskill. Mary, thanks for taking time.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you first, not about either Bad Behavior or Two Girls, Fat and Thin, but about an essay you wrote for Details magazine. It's about Axl Rose, who's one of America's bad
loud
boys.
Loudmouth rock star.
Yeah, loudmouth rock star, right.
Soon to be ex-rock star, I suspect.
Well, you said in this essay that he's kind of an alter ego for America. He acts out what we don't do or talk about. And I was interested in that. How does he do this thing? What does he take on that?
I'm not sure he actually acts out or does anything that a lot of people don't act out and do. I've certainly heard a lot of people say as bad or worse things as Axel. A lot of people beat up their girlfriends. A lot of people rage and scream and act like babies in public. But he being a rock star, being a musician, it has a different feel to it because I hate to use this elevated word in connection with Axel, but he's in some way a performer and an artist simply because he creates songs and sings them and on a mass scale, whether or not you like rock and roll or whether you want to get into discussion of whether it's art or not, it's kind of almost irrelevant. It's like this massive acting out of a certain kind of dream or ritual for people. And so when you see him up on stage or even just hear him flying out of the radio, it's not the same thing as somebody like sitting in a room with you being a shit. It's a kind of ritualized and stylized form of expression of aggression and feeling. And it's not always just aggression. It's usually, like with a lot of rock and roll music, there's a lot of cross currents pulling against each other. Somebody once gave me an interesting comment about rock music generally. She's not from this country, and I don't think she likes rock and roll very much, but she didn't dislike it either. She just said, to me, rock and roll music is all about people trying to break out of jail. It's very constricted, it's very convoluted, and the energy that comes out of it is like spurting out of a very small, constricted space. And that's kind of how I see a lot of suburban America, or suburban sensibility, tremendous amount of energy, but constricted and kind of convoluted in these very small ways. So I've lost myself a little. But so when you hear like somebody like Axl Rose on the radio, it's sort of like a very odd kind of refined aggression and sexuality that you can experience not just vicariously, but that you can connect with as what's in yourself. That's and you can be like a, like I say in the essay, like an 80-year-old woman and have that kind of feeling of aggression, sexualized aggression, very formed, stylized aggression almost. Mm-hmm. And so to hear something like that is like can be a very fun and exhilarating experience, even if you don't have any inclination to act out your life that way or choose to act out your life that way or would want to be sitting in the room with somebody calling you names. Does that make any sense?
Sure. Another article you wrote for, I think this one was for Vogue, yes, on vampires, talked about the same sort of thing, that when we, for centuries now, in Western culture, bring up vampiric images, we're bringing up some part of ourselves that we don't, as I said in the open, bring up in polite conversation.
Yeah, I guess in that essay and also in the Axl Rose thing I was talking about, I think that everybody is capable of the worst things. Everybody has like the most vicious aggression and cruelty in them. And But it takes it, it can come form itself in a lot of ways. Like the thing that interested me about the vampire myth is that the vampire was not just aggressive or cruel. He also represented like the gut part of life. At least in the old vampire movies. I don't know about the more recent ones. I think its dynamic has changed a bit. But the kind of like aggression and cruelty are very deep down impulses. Or rather, that's not quite true. See, this is a problem when you get too abstract. It's hard to explain exactly what you mean. Aggression is a very primal and deep impulse. Aggression is not always cruel, though. Aggression is more like an animal going after something to eat. Cruelty is a lot more convoluted and refined mm-hmm. than that. Cruelty is just for the fun of it. Cruelty is more complicated. But I guess I think they're both connected to things that are very strong life, for lack of a better word, life forces in everybody and that need to be acknowledged and connected with in some way, whether you act them out or not. I don't think you have to act them out to be cognizant of them and aware of them. Like when I was young, I think something I had an interesting experience of in a meditation was that when I was young, when I was a young child, very young, I think I really needed to be around strong, intense energy, a lot of high voltage experience of life, which I think a lot of kids do. And I wasn't able to do that though because everything around me was so held down for a lot of reasons. I'm not really faulting my parents or anybody. There were a lot of reasons that was true, but everything was just sort of held down at a certain level. And I became very fascinated with cruelty in all its forms simply because it was one of the only things around me that had that really intense energy. Not that that's a good reason to be interested in it, but there was a lot of heat and a lot of electricity in that mm-hmm. that I just wasn't getting anywhere else. And I'm not saying that's the only place you could get it, potentially, but for me, that's where it was. Everything else was just kind of blanded out.
You wrote about, in the Axl Rose article, you wrote about a little boy in your neighborhood who was pretty fascinating for you.
Mean little sucker, yeah.
He was a mean little guy, is that what you just said? Yeah. Yeah. Are there words for that? Did that release or explore or permit something in yourself that you didn't have access to or didn't have egress anywhere else in the neighborhood?
No, not really. It all kind of took place in my mind.
In your head. There's two questions at once I want to ask you, and they're both kind of indirectly about Axl Rose and vampire movies. I want to ask you if you think that these kind of cultural evidences in entertainments are healthy in the world, should happen, if Axl Rose is rightly on the stage. In contrast, I want to ask you about the people who say rock music, especially heavy metal, is too loud, too raw, too nasty. Vampire movies are too sexual, too raw, too nasty. There's too much violence in our cultural entertainments. So I guess the first question is, what do you think? And then what do you think about what those people think?
Well, my first reaction to what you said was that this is my first time in Alaska, and I'm from Michigan, so I've certainly experienced cold weather before, but in comparison to like the raw conditions, I think some people live in Alaska, like just dealing with the weather, I think rock and roll's pretty tame. I mean, rock and roll is, you know, it can be very fierce, but as I say, it's a refined, it's very convoluted form, very refined and convoluted form, mm-hmm. compared to more primitive forms of music that are deeper. They may not be as fierce and as loud and screaming and making the faces, but they're more deep. Like rock and roll's really, and I love rock and roll. I'm not putting it down. I think it's a lot of fun, but it's kind of effete almost. Even the really gutty, yelly, screamy White Zombie. Metallica, Megadeth, it's playing. It's like a game. It's not really that violent at all. I mean, they may scream and yell about violent stuff, but like I say, that's something that takes place within everybody, that kind of violence that they're referring to. It's like fantasy in a way. And which is not to say it could never become reality for certain people, but what I'm saying is I don't think most rock and roll, it's playing with the deep gut stuff, it's not really it. And as to whether or not somebody like Axl should be on stage, well, he is, so obviously he should. Obviously, people want to see him. I used to like Guns N' Roses a lot. I don't like them so much anymore, but too raw, too violent, I don't think so.
This is Mary Gaitskill, our guest on this edition of Conversations. We're talking about the subjects of her writing, whether essays or fiction. Her two books are Bad Behavior, a book of short stories that came out in 1988, followed in 1991 by Two Girls, Fat and Thin. Bad Behavior, I think, has been published in 13 countries outside the United States, in addition to its American publication, and Two Girls, Fat and Thin in 8 countries outside the United States. Mary Gaitskill, described as one of the new breed of writers. We'll find out what that's about fairly soon. Mary Gaitskill, our guest on this edition of Conversations.
Can I say something a little bit more about what I just said? Yeah. Again, this is a problem with talking about this stuff on an abstract level. I mean, I'm not saying that rock and roll never has anything to do with violence. I mean, people have been trampled to death at rock concerts and killed at rock concerts. And if you just look at like the early Beatle footage, which is like really very happy poppy music, those girls, those teenage girls that used to just like scream and tear their hair and thrash around, I'm not saying it's like has nothing to do with violence, but it's just like a compulsive kind of, it's like a dissociated kind of aggression in a way, which is why I think it's sometimes people get killed. It's not like fully connected with a more powerful and fully expressed experience of life, and like I think you might hear in other cultures. Mm-hmm. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because like I think if something's kind of convoluted and cut off like that, it does have the potential to be really ugly. But I don't think it's just because it's so raw or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, and I wanted to follow up on something else that you said, or I suppose just the question I asked you about how... Let me phrase it this way. I went to the movies the other night with a friend who said, you know, some anthropologists say that civilization was created to bring under control the kind of animal instincts of the species, to keep us kind of calm and in our chairs. And that's why I wanted to ask you about the so-called civilizing forces that say rock lyrics are too violent, or movies are Silence of the Lambs type movies are too violent, or books like American Psycho are too raw, too violent. And I want to ask your sense of those, quote, civilizing forces, not necessarily your sense of the things that are being criticized themselves.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm just really talking off the top of my head because I'm quite ignorant of anthropology, and I don't really know what I think of civilization versus uncivilization. I think that's a pretty complicated question. But what you just said to me, that somebody thinking that this is music is too violent, or this book, that seems like a very small idea of civilization. Because civilization seemed to me would be able, on a high level, to incorporate all aspects of human beings and tell stories of it or represent it in a way that it could be you would be allowed to experience it without it driving you, without it taking over your life, like to hear loud aggressive, say rock and roll is loud aggressive music, to hear that or to read a book about that and to allow yourself to fully have the experience, which I doubt anybody has in reading American Psycho, but if to allow yourself to fully feel that and yet not sort of be the writer of it rather than having it ride you, that would seem to me to be the ultimate in civilization. And I think that that's probably present in many cultures that we would not consider civilized.
Uh-huh. So,
I don't know enough to give examples of that, but I think probably a lot of I've read some about more primitive cultures who do all kinds of rituals that involve aggression and murder. They don't actually maybe not actually kill anybody, but they're letting themselves experience that without having it out of control. Mm-hmm. I mean that is civilization.
answer any part of this that you want to? Is this one of the reasons that you write as a, I mean, I see you in part as a fiction writer, and I see you in part as a social critic, someone who is holding images and visions of fragments of the society up and saying, look at this, understand that this is part of what we are.
Well, thank you.
Well, I meant it less as a compliment and more as a question.
Well,
I
don't know if I'm doing that or not. I mean, but that's a nice idea. I frankly don't know if that many people read me that I have an opportunity to do that. But that is sort of what I would like to do, yeah.
Uh-huh. You said during a craft talk the other night that you, when you hear things, when you sense things are not being talked about, you sense that something is not being said that's important to be said, then that is the thing that should be talked about, should be explored, should be written about. What is that? Why is that?
I don't know if I said it should. I said that's why that's part of what drives me is to write about things that I feel are being ignored or overlooked. I don't know if I should. It's just what I feel like doing.
I want to rephrase it and ask you about that impulse. Is that something that is explorable for you? What is it when you see that there is silence in the culture about something that says, well, that's what I want to give voice to?
It isn't even so much silence. It's more that I think that, God, I don't know how to talk about this with getting really abstract, but it's like...
Get abstract, that's all right.
There's things in this culture that aren't valued, that are missing, and it's really painful to me to see that happen. And you said something further back that made me think of this. Like, I just feel like people, we seem to be so wanting to have everything exist on a certain level of being positive and happy. Like, I'm not totally against the drug Prozac, so I'm not wanting to give anybody offense with this because I realize it might be helpful to some people in some circumstance. But when I hear people talk about Prozac, I tend to get bothered, not so much by people who are on it, but by people like doctors or people I see on talk shows. They say things like, well, actually, I have heard people who are on it say this, it makes you like you should be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are they talking about? Or well, I just want it to make me like I'm not, so I'm more like normal people who get up in the morning and don't feel dread or anxiety. And I think, who is that? I don't know anybody like that. It's like, I just bring up Prozac example. I'm not about to go off on that, but it's just people seem to have this idea that there's this way that you should be, and that everybody is this way, and it doesn't include a whole lot of leeway. Or when you see movies that are like, we seem to pride ourselves on like movies being so intense and so out there, and I have nothing against Quentin Tarantino. I like his movies, but it's like this is our example of intensity or passion or full-out expressiveness, and it's like nothing. Mm-hmm. It's like tacky. Tacky as in feeling quality. It's like insipid almost. There's like such a lack of deeper feeling, and that include. And I think that's part of the reason people have this idea that this is how Prozac makes you what you should be, because it somehow, even though everybody can talk quite freely about being depressed or whatever, somehow those feelings aren't really allowed to come into play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I think everybody should be walking around moping or anything, but it's just, there's like a certain level of feeling, I can't even quite articulate what I think it is, that's been shut off. And it's like a more softer level of feeling that's more real, and I think is scary to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what to do about that. Does that make any sense?
Sure.
Or do you know what I'm talking about?
Sure. I think for people who've not read either Bad Behavior or Two Girls Fat and Thin, it seems that the protagonists are pretty continually exploring feelings. and these aren't Donna Reed feelings. These are, as I said at the beginning, feelings that we don't frequently acknowledge, but do kind of rumble under the surface of the conversation. Is that the one of the elements that you think in a Prozac Donna Reed world we're not willing to look at openly?
Well, again, I don't want to jump on Prozac, but
I think people understand.
As you were talking, I thought of where I grew up in Michigan. Remember the character in Two Girls, the little girl who everybody makes fun of, they torture her, and they call her emotional.
Emotional. Yeah.
This was a true experience at where I went to school. It was like people were so. It wasn't that they were polite. It wasn't that they were well behaved. They were mean as hell. But it was like you weren't allowed to really feel, and that was the worst insult they could come up with. Mm-hmm. Just intuitively, emotional. God, emotional. That was like the worst thing they could think of to say. I mean, what is this? Mm-hmm. When my first book came out, which is about, in part, some of my characters are interested in like S&M sexuality, and so some people were like, people aren't really out. People in New York. She's writing about people in New York who are weird. And some idiot from Detroit interviewed me once, because this is where I grew up, and he said, he was like, why do you write about these people? And I said, oh, you know, I've seen more perverted people on the playground in Livonia where I grew up. And he was like, I find that hard to believe. Mm-hmm. And I thought about this incident. I mean, calling this girl emotional, like that's the worst thing they could come up with. I think that's perverted. I mean, I think that's a lot worse than anything I might see in some SM bar in New York. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's worse in a different. I mean, they're connected. I think really.
And emotional's only crime is that she is.
She's not cool.
She's not cool.
And by that, I don't even talk. I'm not even talking about fashion, because like what kids come up with their idea of cool is pretty arbitrary. But it's she was just there. She liked things that she liked, and she expressed herself very openly and full out, and she felt, and that was you just weren't supposed to do that unless it was in a certain way.
And when slapped emotionally, she cried.
Yeah.
And then she was open. It felt a lot like she was attacked by all these nasty energies, and the attack just kept going on and on and on. Yeah. Mary Gateskill is our guest on this edition of Conversations. An interviewer in Detroit says to you, how can you write about those things? What's your sense of him? And I mean beyond idiot, beyond. What's going on when people say that stuff's nasty stuff and it doesn't happen outside of peculiar bars in New York City?
I don't know. I mean, it's possible that that they're right in some way, but I don't think so. I can't really say. It's sort of like why my sensibility is different from somebody else's. I can't really explain that. Mm-hmm. Although my sense of him is I had said something nasty about Livonia in an interview, and I think he was mad at me.
But it was personal.
Yeah,
right.
But I was attacking his place. But I don't know beyond that.
Okay. I want to stay with feelings a little bit. In Two Girls, Fat and Thin, both Dorothy, who is the fat girl, and Justine, who is the thin girl, were sexually molested as children, Dorothy for many years by her father, and Justine for a short but extremely traumatic time when she was five. They spend this book separately processing, feeling, and feeling very dark things. But I think, again, this is not a compliment. I'm not looking to compliment you so much as just looking to say I remember this kind of darkness and separation from the life all around me when I was a child. I don't think that these are, I don't think you reached into weird worlds. I guess that's what I'm saying. It felt to me all the way through Two Girls Fat and Thin that these were people who made a lot of sense to me. They make a lot of sense to you.
Yeah, in fact, a lot of Justine, it wasn't just the fact that she was physically, sexually molested. It was like her parents, it's the whole world that she's in. It's almost like even if they love her, their love, what passes for love from them is so cheap. Because they're so disconnected from themselves, it's sort of like being molested is almost more real, mm-hmm. as horrible as it was for her. Because if that had been the only thing to happen to her, that this guy molested her, it would not have been as damaging. She could have recovered from that. But then to come in, to be growing up in this family, which is so... they do love her in a way. They're not like horrible people. They're kind of like typical people in some ways. But they're, for her, violence and violation almost becomes preferable mm-hmm. to this like contempt. It's almost, for her, it's like her spirit isn't allowed to fully exist. And I think that's very common. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of her rage and her, like a lot of her apparent passivity when she gets older and her predilection to attract really cruel, violent people is, I would see almost like not so much passivity or helplessness, but a projection of a lot of rage. And these people are acting out in a way that she can't or chooses not to, but she's almost like taking their aggression in and making it hers.
Yes.
They almost become... her things, her creatures, and it's because it's again, it's what I was talking about when about myself. It's one of the only ways she can experience a really heightened kind of existence. It's very negative, but it's almost preferable to this kind of mealy-mouthed sort of there, sort of not love that she was getting, which I don't consider love at all, by the way. But it was, that's what passed for love in her. Her world.
On this edition of Conversations, Mary Gaitskill and her books, Bad Behavior and Two Girls, Fat and Thin. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. Justine reaches out a lot in her loathing, it seems to me. It's almost like the, I don't know, they say about abused children that an abused child will go for more abuse just to make contact. This is your sense about this person. I don't want to say character because she's more than a character.
Yeah, often I think that's true. Yeah. I mean, people are really complicated and people respond to that kind of abuse in many different ways, but I think that's very common.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels like something.
Is, not to be too blunt, but is this in some ways an indictment of the suburbia that lives on image rather than on reality? Nothing bad ever happens on tree-lined streets.
Well, it was a little bit of a. That kind of statement about where I grew up. I hate to make a statement about suburbs generally because there are too many of them and lots of people live in them and they're very complicated. And even like where I lived, there was a lot of energy. There was a lot of, it wasn't like, I'm afraid I may have made a little bit of an overstatement when I talked about things being bland. There was a lot of energy, but it was so stifled and so mm-hmm. odd that it came out in these sort of thwarted and perverse forms, but there was also, you know, a lot of beauty and a lot of, you know, kids trying to define themselves and expressing themselves in any way that they could. And I'm sure that there were some very kind people that lived there too. So I don't have like a blanket condemnation to make about suburbia or any place else. But I just was very unhappy where I grew up, and I guess it, and I did have a lot of negative things to say about it.
Kind of spilled out in this part. But I think also there was a, Justine grew up a little later than I did, and you grew up a little later than I did, but I remember an odd pressure to not talk about the dark side. We knew that there was a woman down the street who was alcoholic, and we knew that there were kids who were having a very hard time, but it was kind of an undifferentiated hard time in the suburb where I grew up. Perhaps that's why when reading Two Girls, I kept finding realities there, step by step by step. Was it hard to write this book? Was it an emotional process to write this book?
Yeah. And I got led into the childhood stuff more than I was expecting. I wasn't intending it to be about that much about childhood at all. I thought I would just do a very quick flashback and then come out of it. But it actually wound up being most of the book.
Why?
It just kept going on. I just kept thinking of more to say about it. And it was a little, I was a little embarrassed at times because I kept thinking, well, is this really all that interesting? I mean, this is, after all, about children and adolescence, and, you know, isn't this kind of silly? Because I spoke, and a lot of it I speak in the language of children as well, mm-hmm. or teenagers. And sometimes I felt like, well, gee, this just really isn't very elegant. Which it isn't. It's not an elegant book, even remotely. And at times I felt a little uncomfortable with that, and it was hard for me to give myself over to that way of writing, where I was just getting down into the point of view of these people. Mm-hmm. But I did it.
Mm-hmm. What inspired Two Girls? Where did it come from?
Well, it literally was inspired by a woman I met who was very like the main character, Dorothy. I actually did try to write an article on Ayn Rand, which never got published, but I researched it at length and I interviewed a lot of people. And I interviewed this one woman who was just, you know, within 5 minutes of my talking to her, she began to tell me she was raped by her father, and this is why she liked why Ayn Rand had meant so much to her, because it was like the only thing that she felt that she saw in the world representing a sense of honor and dignity and a way of being that she might actually like to emulate. And it was just a very interesting experience because I found her very haunting and very touching, because she was obviously really smart and really aware and sensitive in the sense of being very perceptive, and yet she'd been given so little by the world. She'd just been clobbered by this upbringing she'd had, and then also just because she was uneducated and everything, she had very little tools with which to cope. And yet she took this crappy novelist and this dumb stuff and made it into something wonderful in her own mind. And I don't think it was really had much to do with Ayn Rand. I think it was what she made of it, mm-hmm. that enabled her to not only survive but really have a way of looking at life that had meaning for her, and it sustained her. And I admired that tremendously. And I don't even know that it's that unusual. She was slightly more creative with it than, because she, in her mind, all these characters were so real. And I mean, in some ways, somebody could look at her and think, what a ridiculous woman. She's really out of it. How pathetic. But she wasn't. This world that she'd created was sustaining for her. Mm-hmm. And as I say, very imaginative. And I think a lot of people do that. They fought, maybe not with Ayn Rand, but with, maybe not even with a thing in particular, but they find a way to make their lives work that is against odds and that might look really dumb to somebody else who was looking at it from the outside. Mm-hmm.
This is the thing that we, quote, throw away when we pass a woman like Dorothy on the street and say, ooh, fat slob. We miss the fact that this is a survivor.
Yeah, not only a survivor, but she's, I think she's very vibrant. Like,
me too.
I don't just think, I've been kind of, I was surprised when some critics talked about how depressing she was. And I mean, she is in a way, I guess, but she's also just very vibrant in her mind. And that's really important.
Mm-hmm. The Ayn Rand character, who you call Anna Granite, that's a great name, when she meets Dorothy, gives Dorothy, I think, a wonderful gift by holding out her hands and takes Dorothy's hands in her and says, "You are incredibly strong." It feels for Dorothy as if it's the first time she's ever been seen, I think. Is this a life-changing moment for this character, do you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what does that mean? Life-changing. What happens to Dorothy when someone acknowledges her strength?
Well, I guess it's not life-changing in the way that you'd hear like trumpets and stuff, because her life doesn't really change that much. She's employed by the woman and feels, there's sort of a moment when you feel she is experiencing life very differently. She doesn't feel as alienated from people and things around her. She even has her she feels attractive as a woman for the first time. And she even has a little affair, which kind of winds up blowing up in her face. But nonetheless, it's an experience which she's never had before. And I guess this is, I suppose, where it stops being inspiring, because it's not enough. Ultimately, she isn't able to turn her life around because of that experience. That's sort of like the one peak of her existence, where she was having this engaged experience with these people, this philosophical movement of sorts, and just did experience herself differently. But then ultimately, it wasn't enough to really turn her around. So, and then she had to sort of live it out in her head thereafter. So I guess it's not a kind of turnaround that's a complete triumph. But I still see it as being something of a triumph, just that she's able to hold on to the experience in her mind, even though she's not really able to go forward with it.
It doesn't get buried in Malomars and corn chips, and it stays there for her, right?
Yeah, though it would be better, I agree, if she had been able to continue onward and upward and completely turn her life around, but she's not able to do that. But still, I think even that kind of internal transformation and ability to see yourself as a person who counts is something, and it's better than a lot of people ever do.
Mm-hmm. And is this what you want me to carry away when I read this book? Dorothy counts, Justine counts.
Yeah, that's one of the things. I can't really say everything. It's hard for me to be so objective about it at all, because I haven't read it in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I'll think of it really when I read it 10 years from now. That's one of the things I'd like you to carry away, or just like somebody wrote me a letter once saying that after he read it, he would think twice before coming to such quick conclusions about people. And I was really glad he said that, because that is something I would like people to feel after they finish it. But other than that, I guess I would just like people to feel slightly more open to the strangeness and beauty of that can coexist with really ugly circumstances, because of the vitality and the verve that can exist even when things look just really hideous mm-hmm. and stupid.
Mm-hmm. I asked you if writing this book was hard. Was it also fun?
No, I actually can't say that it was. Writing is almost never fun, unfortunately. Although, well, there are little moments that are kind of fun. If I'm describing somebody or something and I'm fighting with it, and then I suddenly, it's like a feeling current almost. Suddenly I can get into this certain feeling current about the character and describe them in a way I would like, and that way I feel is accurate. That doesn't usually happen that often, though. It's usually pretty grimy, teeth-gritting, uphill stuff.
Mm-hmm. Throwing out this word and shoving another one in its place. You said at the... Let me stop, though, and let folks catch up with this. If you've tuned in late or if you're wondering why I haven't reintroduced, let me do that, please. Our guest today is writer Mary Gaitskill. You can find her works in several places. The essays are likely to appear in The Village Voice or in Details magazine, in Vogue and Harper's Bazaar, Three Penny Review, in Esquire, Mirabella, and Harper's. But it's a nice spectrum of journals you've got here. If you're interested in particular, the Axl Rose article was in Details in July of 1992. Unearthing Dracula, the essay about vampires, in November of 92, and that was in Vogue. One for Harper's is particularly interesting on not being a victim, sex, rape, and the trouble with following rules. That was in March of 1994. You can also find Bad Behavior in paperback, a Poseidon Press book published in 1988, and Two Girls Fat and Thin, also by Poseidon, in 1991. Our guest today, urban fiction writer and also suburban fiction writer, Mary Gaitskill. You said at a craft talk you gave while in Fairbanks that style is very important to you, but style didn't mean the first definition that we might make of it. Can you tell me what's in writing, what makes for style?
Well, it was a definition I actually heard a long time ago by a guy who was sort of a mentor to me. He wasn't a teacher. He was a guy who worked in a used bookstore and did nothing but read and read and read and read. He was a really old guy, and it's possible he's read everything, like medieval poetry up until the most modern stuff. But I was just talking with him about style and how I thought style was so important, and he said, well, style is really a byproduct. And I said, no, it's not. Because to me, style is so, I enjoy style so much that I can get pleasure out of nothing but that in reading, regardless almost of what they're talking about.
The way the words are on the page.
Though, yeah, the images that are created and the feel of the sentences. But so when he said that, I argued with him, but then it became clear to me that it is, in the sense that if style and the substance are working well together, then the style is a byproduct in the sense that it's sort of the inevitable outcome of your pursuit of what you're trying to say. If you're going after something in a certain way, it's sort of like the insides of a flower will ultimately result in the way the flower looks. They're inseparable. And so it's a similar thing with writing, I think. It's like the internal workings of what you're doing will result in the physical appearance or aesthetic appearance of the work. Mm-hmm. And
you put your eye on Dorothy and she emerges fully on the page.
Yeah, but you have to really get into her first.
And I'm sure that the opposite's not true, that if you put your mind on style, you probably couldn't get Dorothy.
That's probably true, although sometimes when I get into writing, I do it by not so much, maybe not style, but I focus very much on small details, like what's in the room, physical objects in the room, the movements of their hands, little piece of fleck under their eye or something. Mm-hmm. And for some reason that enables me to enter into the characters in a way that I can't do if I focus first on an idea about the character. I don't know why that is, but it's an idiosyncrasy maybe.
Yeah, you go in the door through the small thing rather than the big picture.
Yeah.
Sure. Who stroked their nose hairs in your life? In two books it's come out.
My dad.
Two stories. Oh, your dad did that.
I hope he's not listening.
Probably not. Yeah, it was a father who did it in the story you read at your reading. That's right. That's right. Since Mary Gaitskill's been in town in the late fall of 1994, she's been active in the University of Alaska Fairbanks English Department, working with graduate level writers and giving a craft talk and readings and working in classes. She read a story during her reading that is not yet published, I think, right?
It is actually. It is published in a small quarterly in California.
Oh, and the quarterly's name?
Three Penny Review.
Oh, in the Three Penny Review. And the name of that story was?
Tiny Smiling Daddy.
Tiny Smiling Daddy. It's about, if you're interested in finding this, it's a lovely story. It's about a daughter who grows up, leaves home, and writes for a major magazine about her father, and her father hears about this in an odd way, and the story is about as he seeks out the magazine and comes to terms. Mary Gaitskill, our guest today on Conversations. I couldn't resist asking about nose hairs. Tell me about what is urban fiction from your perspective. Does that moniker mean anything to you when people say she's one of a new genre of writers called urban fiction writers?
No, not that much. I think it probably means something. I used to take the position that it meant nothing. It probably means a little something, just because I do think you're influenced by your environment some way or other. And since I lived in New York City for 10 years, it did affect my writing insofar as I tended to write people about people who were located in New York and the sort of peculiarities that New York people have to deal with. But on a deeper level, I don't think it matters that much, because I probably would have dealt with similar themes and similar sort of undercurrents had I not lived in New York, had I lived somewhere else. It may have come out somewhat differently, but I don't think it would have been that big a difference. And I don't think my writing necessarily has anything to say about New York. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not the New York that many other people live in.
This kind of edginess and focus on the fringe is more a focus on elements of people,
yeah,
rather than place.
Right.
It's not Detroit fiction or New York fiction, it's fiction.
Right.
How about suburban fiction? Because you write that too,
uh-huh,
it seems to me.
Well,
is this an issue of simply writing out of your own experience?
Yeah, I think that's all it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are you writing about these days?
I'm writing about, it's probably will be a short novel about two women friends, one of whom is sick with HIV, and in the course of the story contracts AIDS and dies. And it's somewhat of a difficult relationship, because they are not close in the normal sense of the word, and it's hard for the one who's not sick to know how to maintain the friendship. And it's just about that, basically.
Mm-hmm. Has your tell me if I know this accurately. My understanding is you wrote for a decade or so before you were published.
Mm-hmm.
But you worked with some very good writers at the University of Michigan and received an award for your writing, yes?
I did. I didn't really work with writers because they didn't have a writing program then.
Mm.
That happened just after I left. They were professors, mostly. And I mainly got most of my help from that guy in the used bookstore I mentioned.
Uh-huh.
Really good reader.
That's interesting. I guess what I'm wondering about is that two things. One is the sense that you are a writer, whether you're published or not, and then the sense that the culture welcomes you as a writer, which has happened to you relatively recently in the last 6 or 7 years. And if this is a change for you.
Oh, yeah.
And what's that like?
Well, it was great.
The last part.
Yeah. I wasn't expecting it to happen in such a dramatic way, like to get a book published and have it do well. I was more expecting to go the usual, what I guess is the usual route of having things published in small quarterlies, and then maybe in a bigger magazine, and then a collection come out. But I didn't have anything published in the small quarterlies or in other magazines. And my agent actually had the idea of selling it as a book, which I thought was a dumb idea. I didn't think it would work. But I was just flabbergasted when not only was it sold, but it did well.
Has this meant changes in the life of Mary Gaitskill? or is this external? That's what I'm wondering about.
You mean internal changes?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was very confirming in a way I had never experienced before, not only in the fact that the book was accepted and liked, at least by some people, but the things that I had written about, I guess I did sort of think, I had been very isolated a lot of the time in my 20s, and I did have some feeling that maybe I was really weird, or maybe I just didn't realize how that other people would relate so much or know exactly what I was talking about. And for that to happen was just amazing for me. It was a little disorienting and odd, too, because I felt sort of like I'd been writing about things that for me were very private, and then for them to be so public, I mean, for me, they were public. I mean, the book wasn't a bestseller, so it wasn't like that public, but as far as I was concerned, it was plenty public enough. And it felt like the roof had been taken off my house almost, and it made me feel very odd. But it was also good. It was mainly good to get, you know, people coming up to me and saying that they had experienced things exactly like that, and it was just stunning. I mean, just absolutely stunning. In a way, I didn't have the psychological tools to deal with it, though, because you know, of course they hadn't experienced things exactly like I had. They were just, when people read, they don't necessarily read the story the way you wrote it or the way you wanted it to be read. There's just so much that goes on between the page and the reader. So I was getting a certain amount of projection and stuff that didn't really, as far as I was concerned, relate to me. And I was kind of puzzled for a while as to how to deal with that. That's why I left New York and went to Marin County. I just really wanted to be by myself. But ultimately it was good, and it also helped me release certain very negative things. It's actually, you know, sometimes people say, I was talking to some silly psychiatrist who I met socially, and she was friendly, basically. I shouldn't make fun of her, but she was saying that she had read some of my stories and she didn't understand why. She thought they were very well written, but why would anybody want to put that out in the world? And I didn't really have an answer for her at first, because, I mean, well, why put anything out in the world, really? But then I thought, because not for one thing, it not only to really put a light on something and reveal it and do so with a certain level of compassion, not just understanding, but compassion, it releases it, not just for you, but for the people who read it. Mm-hmm. I think.
Because it doesn't have the charge of secrecy. It doesn't have the charge of underworld anymore. It's out in the light.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, I mean, I don't know if that's why I do it. I don't know why I write stories, really, but that's part of it. It's, for me, it was a good thing, anyway.
Do you have any trouble turning off the light of the public mind when you go to write now?
A little bit, yeah. And I'm sorry about that, because I do think it's really bad, because when I was first writing, I was very unself-conscious. I wasn't necessarily thinking anybody would read the stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's a very good place to write from, because then you're not worried about what people are going to think. And if you know people are going to read what you're writing, you can become really self-conscious and worry about... You can anticipate exactly what certain critics will say, although you're probably wrong anyway, but you're worried about how people will take it, and that's doom if you start listening to that too much. I'd like to say I close it out completely, but I probably don't.
I asked you earlier if you wanted me to carry something specific away from Two Girls Fat and Thin, but in the relatively few minutes we have left, I want to ask you if you think readers have an obligation. Do I, when I pick up a book, have any obligation past entertaining myself?
Gee. I don't usually think of it as an obligation, but I don't know if obligation is the right word, but I would like readers to be responsible for themselves in a way, in that they are not expecting me or needing me or requiring me to give them the world as they think it's supposed to be, or to confirm their opinions or support their emotional needs. That's not what reading is about for me. And when you're reading, you need to be able to to see the thing for what it is without having to have yourself confirmed. It may not confirm you at all. It may present you a world that you think is just not how you would like to see it. Mm-hmm. But it's even so, you can take a delight in how it's presented if you're able to say, well, you know, okay, like people criticize John Updike sometimes because they think he's misogynist or they think his people are snotty or horrible or whatever. That's irrelevant to me. I don't need to have his characters be nice or have him be nice to his characters or have him like women, or I'm not going out on a date with John Updike and I never will. So when I come into his books, I'm not looking to see him be nice to women. I'm looking to see mm-hmm. him tell how he sees the world from as truthfully and as from his gut as he can, with all his wonderful intellect and refinement as well. I don't have to buy into that, or, you know, live my life that way or believe anything he says to me. I can still just delight in it and respect it. So I guess that's what I would like. I mean, to me, that's being responsible for yourself. That's like, okay, here I am, here he is, we're going to interact here, and I'm going to enjoy this, and he doesn't have to do anything for me.
I stand separately looking at him looking.
Yeah.
And then look at the thing he looks at, but being careful to know what my position is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. So the reader is the observer.
Yeah, and you can take in or not take in anything you want. And you can appreciate the beauty of something and get back to Axl Rose. I don't subscribe to Axl Rose's opinions about anything that I've ever heard him express. I don't have to. I can still just enjoy the energy of him, that real intense, hot, masculine, glandular energy. That's mine. When he puts it out there on the radio, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter what he thinks or feels or has to say about anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I may watch Axl Rose with a new set of eyes.
Well, he's gone a little downhill, I think. Those little shorts, horrible.
Mary Gaitskill on Conversations. Thanks for spending an hour with us.
You're welcome.
Mary Gaitskill is now living in San Francisco. She has done some teaching at San Francisco State University and also the San Francisco State Art Institute. While she was in New York, she taught a writing workshop as well. In Fairbanks, she's worked with writing students in the graduate program here at, In Fairbanks, she has worked with writing students here in the English department, worked in classes, given a craft talk, and fielded questions like the ones today. If you're looking for her books, look for Bad Behavior, look for Two Girls Fat and Thin. Any idea when that new book might drift into print?
Hopefully sometime in the next 2 years, but I'm not sure. It may take me a longer time than that to write it.
Sometime before 1997, perhaps.
Yeah.
Are you a fast writer or slow writer?
Slow. I've been working on this thing for a few years. I still don't know when it'll be finished.
Are you patient?
No.
Or impatient?
Well, I have to be patient. So I guess I am.
Mary Gaitskill, our thanks. Look for Bad Behavior, look for Two Girls Fat and Thin in the meantime, and something else coming out soon. And I expect you should keep your eye out for essays in some fairly major magazines. I'm Susan McGinnis. It's been a pleasure, Mary. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And I hope you join me again next week. Thanks.